Thank you, Rachel. I'm really excited about today's Hot Topic call. We have Joanne Ikeda, who is the former SNEB president, has been a member for many, many years of Weight Realities Division. I'm sure she's been the chair of Weight Realities before, if not multiple times. She's also had research published in Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, and her research areas have been in foodways of minority populations living in California and weight management in children. She was focused on that as a preventative measure to kind of protect children from having to go through the weight management that adults in our society have to go through. She is currently a nutrition consultant for Cartoon Network, editor of Nutrition Policy Institute newsletter, and nutritionist emeritus at the Department of Nutritional Sciences, University of California, Berkeley. So welcome. Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you for that introduction. Did you want to say how it's going to work, Amber?
Sure. So I think what we'll do is have Joanne talk a little bit about Health at Every Size, kind of just a brief summary of what it is and what it isn't. You know, she's been an advocate, one of the founders really of the Health at Every Size movement for many years and has gotten a lot of questions about it. So she can kind of dispel some myths for us right off the bat, and then as people have questions, they can kind of pipe up and say, well, what about this or what about that, and then she would be happy to answer those.
Okay, well, let me just say that my disillusionment with dieting and weight control began in the mid-1990s when I read the research by Stephen Blair showing that fat, fit men had half the mortality rate of unfit, lean men. And he also published the same kind of results with women, which led me to believe that there are indeed people who are categorized as overweight and obese who are metabolically healthy. And as a consequence, I became more and more interested in an approach that would be health focused rather than weight focused. That determination to develop such an approach grew over the years as I saw more and more research come out showing that in fact there were fat-fit people. Particularly the NIH data from 2003, showing that a quarter of normal weight people were metabolically unhealthy, whereas a half of people categorized as overweight were unhealthy, and a third of people categorized as obese were metabolically healthy. So it said to me that we've really been focused on the wrong thing. We need to be focused much more on metabolic health. And so that's what the Hayes approach is. It's not an approach to say health doesn't matter. In fact, it very much says it's not.
Did we lose Joanne?
We might have. Let's see if she gets called back in a second.
Hello, did you lose me?
Yes, we lost you.
Pardon? I was talking about physical health, and let me just say that when you have a list of indicators of physical health, there are actually about 8 of them, and they include things like blood pressure, triglycerides, plasma glucose, C-reactive protein, insulin resistance, LDLs, HDLs, cholesterol, and then waist circumference, BMI, or weight. So as you can see, when we talk about metabolic health, we're talking about a much broader parameters of indicators. In HAES, we also take into account mental health, having to do with self-esteem, body image, happiness measures, body satisfaction, self-efficacy, and then social health, having to do with being able to form meaningful personal relationships with others. So I think that our definition is much more broad and much more encompassing, and you can't sacrifice one area of health for another. And I think that's what we've done for years. We've tried to make fat people feel bad with the idea that that will empower them to lose weight. Well, I'm sorry, but the research literature shows that when you make people feel badly, they lose all hope and a sense that they are basically helpless. So with that, I'll turn it over. Maybe you have some questions now.
Hi, Joanne. This is Amber. I do have a question right off the bat to get started.
Sure.
So what would you say to people who would say, I'm not all about making people feel bad for their weight, but I still feel that they need to change their weight? So I'm going to take an approach that is, you know, it's weight focused, but I'm trying to be positive about it. What would you say to that person?
Well, you're still essentially telling that person that there's something wrong with their body, when in fact it may not be. If you haven't evaluated all these other parameters, you don't know that. The other thing is you're asking people to do something that it's almost impossible to do. I don't know how many people have read the research of Jeff Friedman from the Rockefeller Institute in New York, but he's a biochemist, biologist. He discovered leptin, and if you read his writings, you will see that he basically can show that it's almost impossible to overcome the biological controls of weight. And in fact, we have the lovely Look Ahead study, which was funded in the late 1990s. In fact, we tried to get in on that study, but we were refused. And the whole focus of the Look Ahead study was to prove that people could, in fact, lose weight and keep it off. And they enrolled 5,100 people in that study. So we are not talking about something that is a short term. It went on for 8 years, and the ninth year they did what's called a futility analysis, showing that the weight loss would not change after 8 years. They got what they were going to get. And believe it or not, the women in the study lost an average of 9 pounds. The men in the study lost 1 pound, and the dropout rate was 84%. Now, if that doesn't show that pressuring people or even supporting people in a nice way to lose weight doesn't work, then why do we continue to do that? Why are we telling people, oh, you can lose weight and keep it off, when in fact the research does not support that?
Thank you for answering that.
Someone else must have a question.
Yeah, this is Carrie Durward from Utah State University.
Uh-huh.
Just to follow up on the previous question, what about what would you say to the same kind of question, except for putting the spin on it, that, you know, often people are coming to us because they want to lose weight. You know,
mm-hmm.
They've decided that that's what's best for them. Do you really think it's our job to tell them that it's impossible and that there's no way it's going to happen for them, and that that shouldn't be their goal?
But the way I handle, and I do medical nutrition therapy at a Medical Clinic in downtown Oakland for people without health insurance. So I indeed see patients, just like a lot of you do. It was volunteer work for me. I decided here I had taught people how to do it for so many years, I'm going to go out and do it. So when people come to me and say they have to lose weight, what I tell them is, okay, we're going to take a look at what you're eating and how physically active you are, and I'm going to ask you questions and you're going to share with me. So we're going to talk about some ways to improve your health. And we may actually see some improvements like lower blood pressure, lower cholesterol levels, that sort of thing. We may or may not see loss of weight. It would be nice if we got loss of weight, but if we don't, we don't want to get on the yo-yo dieting track because that basically increases your risk of cardiovascular disease. So I also ask them, of course, how many times have you tried before and how many times has the weight come back? And are you at a higher weight now than you were when you began? And indeed, many of them are. And many of them understand that they've tried to diet before. It hasn't particularly helped. And maybe trying this other way might be more successful. Any questions about how people take that?
Yes, how do people take that? This is Linda.
Okay, well, basically, I think they take it very well. A lot of them do say that they're worried about their health and they would like to improve their health. And that, okay, well, if I lose weight, that would be wonderful. But if I don't, it would be nice to be healthier. And so I'm surprised. There are very few people who actually reject that. I did have one mother of a 8-year-old who was very stressed out. She was a single mother. She lived in a very high income area, and all the other little girls' mothers were svelte and thin and dressed in designer clothes, and she didn't have the income nor the body shape to compete with these mothers. And so what I had to work with her on was, you know, what is beautiful? Is beautiful the external things, or is it the internal things? And we had quite a nice discussion, and I think by the time I got done, she realized that she didn't have to buy into that value system, and maybe she didn't want her daughter to buy into it.
I just add something to that, Joanne?
Oh, please do.
Yeah, so this is Amber again. You know, I work with eating disorder patients at a psych hospital, as Rachel said. And that has been what you just said has been one of the absolute key parts of working with the families of the eating disorder patients, is kind of dispelling the myth that society pushes that, you know, losing weight or being a certain body size or type is the ideal. Or is necessary for good health, and when in fact changing some behaviors could make you feel better and actually be healthier, that message only seems to work if they don't buy into this in ideal, like you were saying, trying to convince that woman. But if someone has bought into this in ideal and they come to us as, you know, dietitians or the nutrition educator saying, I want to lose weight, then there's really not going to be any changing their mind. And there's kind of like the last question, it's not really our place to try to change their mind. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't think you can change people's minds. You can challenge them to think about changing their minds by presenting opposite points of view or other points of view. But they've got to go home and consider this for a while, and maybe they will or maybe they won't. Some people change their social setting. As I mentioned, the mother who was so pressured by her daughter and her daughter's classmates, you know, that she actually started making friends outside of that social circle, and she felt so that she was reinforced in size acceptance and the idea of everybody comes in a different size and shape, and that's okay. But I agree. You can't impose change on somebody. In fact, that was something I really emphasized to my students was whose responsibility is it to make changes? And so as I work with patients, you know, I'm asking questions and I'm posing possibilities and we're talking about, well, will that work? Why might it not work? Is there something else that would be and more attractive to do, that sort of thing?
I have a question. This is Paula. I previously worked in a college health setting, and I worked with a lot of students with eating disorders. And I did both training in intuitive eating and also the health at every size. I did a self-study course many years ago in the late 90s. So one of the problems I had, and it wasn't with my patients, it was with selling this to other healthcare providers and practitioners. Do you have any advice on how to get buy-in from allied health professionals and other physicians that you're working with?
Well, what I find with most health professionals is they believe in what they were trained in that way back when they got their training. For example, I was told when I went to Cornell, and I was told that all obese people needed psychiatrists, so I didn't really need to learn anything about treatment because I wouldn't be doing that. I then read Stunkard's Fear of the Pain of Obesity, and that certainly convinced me otherwise. I don't know how many of you have read Mickey Stunkard, but he's one of the most famous psychiatrists in the world, and published this wonderful book, The Pain of Obesity, way, way back in the 60s. And it was the stories of patients he had and the way they were suffering, not from being obese, but from being discriminated against and being treated like outcasts. And that's very sad. I don't think I answered your question. Would you? Did I?
Sure. I was just wondering if you had any advice for me to sell this approach to other healthcare providers.
Well, what I usually do is try to get together some research articles that support my point of view, and that is certainly the problem with the look-ahead study is everything they've published the figures and percentages, so there's no sense sharing those articles because, quite frankly, there was a real reluctance to admit that they had failed. In fact, all of the articles sound very rosy. But certainly the NHANES data, and I have a reference for that article that shows that fat people can indeed be healthy, I think is worth sharing with them. That was published by Wildman, Wildman, 2008 in Archives of Internal Medicine. It's August 2008, and it's the obese without cardiometabolic risk factor clustering and the normal weight with cardiometabolic risk factor clustering. Showing something like that, which should at least broaden their minds in terms of, you know, weight does not equal health. And they, in fact, have patients who are obese who may be quite, they probably have at least some of them that are metabolically healthy. The other article that I often share is the one by UCLA. Linda, you're on the line. Do you remember the article that UCLA did, a review of the literature, and said that the conclusion was that weight loss diets did not work?
No, I don't remember that one, Joanne. Sorry.
Okay. Anyway, it'll come to me. But I think also anything that you can say about discrimination, and because doctors are just like the public. You know, they think that people who are fat are out of control, that they're gluttons, that they're sitting on the couch every day. And that just is so harmful. I mean, there's so many women who don't go to see a doctor because every time they do, they're told that their problem is due to their weight. You know, one woman said to me, I thought I had a broken arm, but I didn't want to go see the doctor because he would have said, well, lose weight. So I think sharing and just sharing the idea, I think the principles of Hayes also are very important. And the fact that the dieting people don't have any principles. I mean, basically, it is not a principled approach.
Can you talk about the principles a little bit, Joanne?
Sure. The principles are on the Association for Size Diversity and Health website. Let's see. They and I can go over those principles. I have them on some. Just go back a little way. One of them, the first one, really has to do with the acceptance of size diversity, and I think that is so important. I think we have basically not accepted the fact that people have different sizes and shapes. I'm still going through. There we go. Okay, the first principle, accept and reject the inherent diversity of body shapes and sizes. Accept and respect the inherent diversity of body shapes and sizes and reject idealizing or pathologizing of specific weights. Health enhancement, support health policies that improve and equalize access to information and services that improve human well-being with attention to individual physical, economic, social, spiritual, emotional health. The third one has to do with respectful care and without bias. And the fourth one has to eat for well-being. Rather than any regulated eating plan focused on weight control. And the fifth one has to do with enhancing movement. That is finding movement that you enjoy and continue to do. So these are, and you can read the entire principles, as I said, if you go to the Association for Size Diversity website.
Diane, this is Joanne, this is Linda. Linda Bobroff, University of Florida, and I work in Extension Nutrition Education. One of the programs that our Extension faculty have been involved in is the National Diabetes Prevention Program. And you're probably familiar with it. It's based on the Diabetes Prevention Program, the DPP, that was a research study. And that study did clearly show that modest weight loss significantly associated with lifestyle changes, significantly reduced diabetes risk over a period of years among people who had prediabetes, so they were at very high risk for getting diabetes. Mm-hmm. And they did tease out the weight loss, and it was the modest weight loss, and we're talking 5 to 10% of body weight, so that is very modest. Not what people expect to lose when they go into go on a diet. So if they weigh 200 pounds, they don't expect to lose 10 to 20 pounds. They expect to lose 50 or more. So the National Diabetes Prevention Program is based on that study and does emphasize weight loss. It also emphasizes increasing physical activity, eating a healthful diet, and all the positive things that we like to promote in our programs. So in the back of people's minds, yes, they do want to lose weight, but they're also in a year-long program where group support is a very important component. So what do you think about that program? And there's no way they're getting rid of weigh-ins. That's not going to happen because that's part of what you report when you want to become a recognized provider of the program. But there is an emphasis certainly on healthy lifestyles, feeling good about yourself, and certainly in our program we focus on those components while quietly weighing people as they come in.
Sure. Well, I can understand why you're in a situation like that. Many are in situations like that where the only way they can get anything is to focus on weight problem is that the diabetes study went on for how long?
It was a couple of years, but they did follow up for, I don't know, 3 more years, something like that. It's probably no more than 5 years, but if you don't get diabetes for 5 years, that's a significant thing, even if you get it in the 6th year.
Right. Okay. So I guess my question is, how many of the people who enroll in the program and lose that 5% maintain it after 5 years? I don't think we know that. I know in the look-ahead study, they published their findings after 5 years, and it was 5%. They did get a maximum of 5%. The problem is with all the dropout rate, that are in your favor, because the people who stay in are the ones who are losing weight, since there is some focus on that. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that, but I'm just saying that I'm not sure it really is getting the result that the people think it is.
Right, but then, you know, according to what Hayes says, if we can have people in a program for a year, and I don't know what their retention rates were, and I'm not sure how they did their statistics. I know in the weight management studies that I've been involved here at UF, you know, apart from the DPP, NDPP, our retention rates over a year are really quite good, up in the, like, 85%.
That's
but
great.
If we can keep people in a year-long program where they're getting, you know, feedback on walking more and healthy eating, and they're dealing with all the lifestyle changes and getting the group support, which is an integral part of the program, that's a year that they are reinforced for their behavior changes, which is what we want anyway. So even if they don't get the weight loss that might be associated with reduced risk for diabetes, they're still carrying something with them, hopefully, you know, for the rest of their lives, and we focus on it as it's a lifestyle change program. It's not a weight loss program. So hopefully we get them to make those changes for a lifetime. That's my hope. Did we lose Joanne again? Uh-oh.
Yeah, maybe. I was going to say, her connection sounded like it might have been.
I know. Or I didn't know if you lost me. Okay, so somebody's out there.
Yeah, somebody is out here.
And this discussion is so phenomenal. I'm hoping that there's somebody who might feel comfortable talking with Linda about this and going back and forth, because I hope it continues. I hate that we lost Joanne, but is there anybody else who would be willing to respond?
Linda, this is Amber again.
Hey, Amber.
I can say a little bit about my thoughts if you're interested. I think that what you're saying is really powerful, because that is very often an argument, not an argument against Hayes, but an argument of why Hayes isn't black and white. Like, not just using Hayes, but actually trying to get it to work within other programs, and that's kind of like what it sounds like you're saying. Like, we want to support people, not discourage them. We want to focus on the behaviors and just kind of keep weight on the back burner. I think aside from what Joanne was saying about, you know, the length of the study, the thing that I would be concerned about with regards to Hayes is something like, are all the people who are on the treatment side a certain body type or not overweight, and all the people on the other side overweight? Things where it's kind of like an us versus them, so that the people in the program feel like after the program they're trying to be like somebody that was treating them, and not like themselves. Does that make sense?
Do you mean the people who were teaching the program?
Right.
Oh, well, I have had county extension faculty who are large women tell me that they feel funny teaching a weight management program or a lifestyle program because of their size.
Yeah.
So that's a personal decision. Some, you know, I don't tell our county faculty what they have to teach. They can teach what they want. But that, I think, is an issue on the part of some of our faculty that they feel, you know, well, who am I to tell people they should live a healthy lifestyle if they're going to look at me and think, well, she probably doesn't because she's very large, which may not be true at all, as Joanne was saying. So that's an issue for some people who teach the program. And, you know, we don't say if you're large, you can't teach the program, obviously. Anybody
right.
can. So I don't know. You know, we do have some dietitians who work in our NIH-funded projects who were pretty small and very fit. And, you know, they can serve as a role model in terms of, oh, you know, looking great, feeling great, and this and that. Not that everybody's going to strive to be their size, but at least the being strong and having a positive attitude or whatever. I think they can inspire people. They might depress some people that I'm never going to look like that. But, you know, those are things we work out, and we do so much group support in our both the diabetes prevention program as well as our weight management studies that's on the research side. And believe me, over the years I've had guilt and second thoughts and weirdness about being part of Weight Realities and also being part of NIH-funded projects that definitely focus on weight loss, but also focus on, you know, in those we also focus on healthy lifestyles as well and encourage people, you know, whether or not they've lost weight. Oh, so what are some successes that you've had this week? You know, oh, you had another vegetable, low starch vegetable, that's great. And, you know, and we process a lot of stuff and are very, very positive in terms of people making lifestyle changes, whatever, you know, happens when they get on the scale, which they do because you're not going to get funded by NIH if you don't report some
right.
about like weight. Anyway, that was a long answer.
So this is,
can I go back to something that you said earlier? When you said that there was, you know, there were people who were larger size who were unwilling to teach because they felt funny. And then later said, you know, there are people who are role models and they're looking great, feeling great, and they're smaller. That's what I'm, right, that kind of like a thinking that those people who are smaller are role models because they're looking great. And
yeah,
the people who are.
I have a problem with that too.
Well, yeah,
bigger.
And I heard that when I said that, and I think what I was saying was that's in people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting at is that it's in people's minds, and so when there's a program that focuses on weight, even if it's a little bit, that's in their minds while they're in the program. That's all. That was my comment. But I think we have Joanne
right
back now. So
right.
I think you have to be.
But I was also
very
saying
very
that the focus in the program was not on that. Yeah.
Well, this is Terry Durr.
I think with people who, when you hire people who are thin and who are, you know, they're young, they're energetic, they're thin, they also have a hard time believing that large people can be healthy, and they also have a hard time not subtly discriminating against. So I think you have to work very hard to make sure that those staff really understand the pain of obesity. You know, I would literally make it mandatory that anybody who works with a weight management program read that book. I mean, it will bring home to you how people are suffering for no reason other than the fact that their body happens to be large.
And Joanne, can I just say that in our research studies,
sure,
they get a lot of training and supervision. And the PI is a clinical psychologist who is very well aware of that. And that's not an issue on the part of our interventionists because they are very well trained.
Great.
This is Carrie Durward again. I had one comment that I wanted to make and then a question for follow-up. First of all, I'm coming to this call as somebody who, you know, is familiar at Health at Every Size, but has always not felt 100% convinced. And I think one of the places where I am a little bit concerned is the research literature on health at every size. In general, but more specifically, the metabolically healthy obese research literature. So, you know, as I've taken a deep dive into that literature, it definitely looks like, you know, if we just look at one time point, depending on what, you know, parameters of quote-unquote health we choose, there is a percentage of the obese population that doesn't have those parameters. But really what I found is if you throw in all the parameters, you end up with a very, very small percentage of the total population that doesn't have any of these negative health parameters. And so that's a little bit concerning to me. And then the other place where I really, you know, I completely understand and I'm completely on the same page that there's really strong evidence that dieting doesn't work, that weight loss doesn't stick, and that discrimination is having these horrible health effects on our patients and the internalized discrimination that they're feeling. But I don't really feel like the literature on health at every size has given us a viable alternative. I just don't think the studies that have been able to be done are strong enough or so strong enough health outcomes that I can jump in with both feet. And so I definitely see the conundrum, right? Like the previous caller was talking about, NIH isn't going to fund a study unless you do weights at the end of it. And so, you know, I can kind of understand from the outside why maybe those really rigorous studies haven't been done, but I was hoping the people on the call could kind of speak to that question of how do we get those studies done? How do we convince NIH that these studies need to happen? Or is there a different potential funding agency?
I think we do need those studies done. I don't know how you're going to change the minds of NIH. Years ago, when I first started out, before I even developed Hays, I called the person who was director of obesity studies at NIH and basically said, you know, we need to take a look at these large people who are physically fit and metabolically healthy. And he said, there are no such people. If they were, they would be thin. You know, and that just so turned me off. All I could say, well, thank you very much. Goodbye. The most recent research is, of course, the JNEB article that was published in March, April of 2015. And it's an overview of 16 different studies. Basically, and they did have criteria, of course. They threw some studies out, kept those in that met their criteria. And in those 16 studies, they found that people had improved blood lipids, blood glucose, blood pressure, improved body image, self-esteem, more physical activity, improved dietary patterns, decreased dietary restraint and disinhibition, decreased emotional eating and eating disorder symptoms, and low dropout rates. So basically, you know, you can take that for what it is, but I think it sounds very promising. And I think with this kind of promising results, we should go to NIH and say, look, you know, we're not getting promising results out of these other studies. They must have spent, we sat down one time and calculated how many millions of dollars it must have took to do look ahead, because there were 16 centers around the United States. All of them had a primary investigator who, of course, got a salary and had dietitians working for them and so on and so forth. And that was over 10 years, even though that the final data was 8 years. It took a while to recruit 5,100 people. So, I think that we have much more promising results than they do. We don't get those kind of 84% dropout rates. And I understand that Linda's program is probably very different from some of the programs that totally focus on weight and weight loss and counting calories and grams of fat and, you know, all that kind of thing. And there are times when I teach people things like that. I do carb counting a lot with the type 2 diabetics because I think it's a way for them to get in the habit of seeing what they're eating and how it fits with the restraints that they're under. So, okay. I said my thing, but I do think if you don't have that article from JNEB, called Impact of Non-Diet Approaches on Attitudes, Behaviors, and Health Outcomes, a Systematic Review. And again, it's in the March-April 2015 issue. Issue 2. So I can understand your concern, but as I said, this is much more promising than what we're getting out of the weight loss studies. Any other? Come on, guys.
Thank you for that response. I really appreciated what you had to say.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Courtney. I'm a dietitian with the WIC program, and we have a lot of clients and parents who the first question they ask, because we do heights and weights, is, how is my kid's weight? So do you have any suggestions on how we can kind of address issues with kids on their growth charts? For example, I have a 3-year-old kid who gained 14 pounds in 6 months. So we've been talking about making those healthy changes. But just, do you have any tips on kind of working with parents and their kids on kind of how not to just look at weight, but at the same time, for kids, that is kind of important?
Yes. Yes, I do. First of all, I have talked to the head of WIC in California, and I've pointed out that childhood overweight, or if you want to say childhood obesity, is a medical diagnosis. And if you have your paraprofessionals telling people that their child is overweight or obese, they don't have the right to diagnose. So the first thing you need to say is, I have some concerns, or the chart shows that your child may have some weight problems. You need to talk to your pediatrician about it. It's the only one in California, at least, who has the right to make a medical diagnosis is an MD or a physician assistant. I think some nurse categories also may have the right, but in California, we don't. As a dietitian, I do not have the right to make a medical diagnosis. When I work at the clinic, I get the chart, and the doctor has made a diagnosis, and I am working with that diagnosis. So you have to be careful. The other thing is, when a child is large like that, there are some very specific questions that need to be asked of the mother. And that is, in the activity area, how many hours a day does your child watch television? And actually go through a day and count up the hours, because most people have no idea that their child is watching 6, 7, 8 hours of TV a day. It's unbelievable. How much time does your child play outside every day? That's another key question. There are children who never go outside. They live in bad neighborhoods. So the suggestion, are there mothers in your neighborhood who could get together and all take your child to this location at 10 a.m., in the morning and not have to worry about somebody coming by and grabbing your purse or shooting you. Anyway, so there's that. The other key questions are, you know, how many fruits and vegetables is your child eating? And then how much soft drink is your child drinking? That's such a key question. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of two-year-old children who are drinking soft drink every day. If you look at the research literature, it's scary. And I applaud all these efforts to try to decrease. And of course, it not doesn't just include soft drink. It includes all those sugar-sweetened beverages. So those kinds of questions can, and when the parents respond to them, they get an idea that the fact that's how the child got overweight. You know, you don't have to, after that, it's real easy to just key in on, right into the idea that, well, your child may be gaining weight too fast because he's not going outside to play, he's watching too much television, he's not eating enough fruits and vegetables, he's drinking too much soft drink, he's not drinking milk. You know, these kinds of things are key. And I think making sure that your staff know what those key questions are. And I did a lot of training for WIC on what are the key questions that you focus on. In fact, I've even trained physicians on the key questions because they've got the 15-minute office visit, you know, to get through and what questions should he ask in the 15 minutes. So I hope that helps.
Yes, it is. And those are things that we're definitely working on in my site. And the HAVE program is something I was trying to figure out of, you know, is this something that works with WIC and all the guidelines with the USDA so that we have. So that is helpful that we're kind of on the right track with that. So thank you.
Good. All right. There must be more people who haven't asked questions. Now's your chance.
This is Linda. I apologize. I have to get off because we have a 2:00 programming meeting, and
okay.
I'm head of one of our teams, so I have to be on the Skype call. But thank you, Joanne, so much for doing this.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I appreciate it. Bye.
Bye. Okay. No, we're almost. Yes.
Yeah, we're at the top of the hour, but if anyone else has any questions, I was going to mention that the HAVE's curriculum, S&EB played a part in developing that, and if I'm correct, that's still available for free. I think the website is haescommunity.com. Is that correct, Joanne? haescommunity.com?
It's, I have it right here. Let me go down to that slide. I have a slide presentation.
Oh, haescommunity.org, and I think they also have developed a Spanish language version recently.
Yeah, it's haescurriculum.com.
Okay.
HTTPS, you know, the usual four word, and then just haescurriculum.com, and you'll get there. And the
association.
I'll just give this. The Association for Size, Diversity, and Health is www.sizediversityandhealth.org. And you can get the principles and a lot of resources for free there also.
Excellent.
Okay,
well
thank
Joanne,
you all
yeah,
for
participating.
Okay,
just
well,
a reminder.
Bye.
We did record today's call, so if you wanted to share this information with someone else, we'll have it up on the S&EB website in the next, probably by the end of the day on Friday, so you can access this recording. And then, as always, any other resources, webinars, or upcoming Hot Topics calls are up on the website. So thank you for joining us today.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.